This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In recent weeks, and for obvious reasons, all eyes have been on Gaza. But more Palestinians live in what is called the West Bank, and the area is critical to any chances of a durable peace or to an expansion of the violence. So what is happening there right now? What's likely to happen? And does it entail more disaster or hold out the prospect of a settlement? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. The West Bank has a complicated history, and to help us understand it, we're joined by Dr. Anne Irfan, a historian of the modern Middle East at University College London. Anne Irfan, where is the West Bank? And I suppose another way of putting the question is, what is it the West Bank of?
It's technically the West Bank of the River Jordan. It is an area of land between Israel and Jordan, and it has since 1967 been under Israeli occupation, but its population is majority Palestinian.
OK, now, where is it in relation to Gaza?
It is not contiguous with Gaza. It is northeast of Gaza, but the two territories are separated by the State of Israel.
OK, now, let's talk about how the West Bank as a thing was created. I think we roughly know that the UN recommended the setting up of two states, one Israeli Jewish state and one Arab. What was the West Bank in that supposed to be in that lineup?
So the UN partition plan was actually issued in 1947, and it envisaged, as you said, two states. The West Bank, as it's currently constructed in terms of its current borders, did not exist in any guise in the partition plan. A much larger area than the West Bank was going to be designated to an Arab state under the UN partition plan in 47. That did not come to pass. Instead, Palestine essentially descended into violence, into what we might call civil war. There was violence on both sides. And then in May 1948, David Ben-Gurion, who became the first prime minister of Israel, declared the establishment of the State of Israel. But crucially, when he did so, he did not declare its borders. So the fighting continued for a long time after that. And as many will be aware, subsequently, many Arab states declared war on the new State of Israel. And displacements and fighting continued until 1949, when we have armistice agreements between Israel and the neighbouring Arab states. And it was in one of those armistice agreements that we got the current borders of the West Bank as part of the agreement between Israel and Jordan.
And the West Bank went to?
The West Bank was then annexed by Jordan in 1950, and it remained under Jordanian rule until 1967.
Right, OK. So there's this area, and essentially it's under Jordanian administration. And then in 1967, you have the war, and the Israelis take it over. But they don't actually annex it.
Correct, yes. It remains under Israeli occupation. Israel does annex East Jerusalem, but it does not annex the rest of the West Bank.
OK, right. Now, what can we say about the population currently in the West Bank?
Right. So jumping forward to today, we have a majority Palestinian population in the West Bank, but we also have very significant numbers of Israeli settlements, Israeli Jewish settlers living in the West Bank as well. One thing that's crucial to keep in mind about this is that these two populations, so the Palestinian population of the West Bank and the Israeli Jewish settler population, live under different regimes. The Palestinians essentially live under Israeli occupation for the most part, whereas Israeli settlers have full Israeli citizenship, so they operate under Israeli civil law.
And we often hear the word settler in relation to the West Bank. You've used it again.
Mm-hmm.
What and who is a settler?
In this context, a settler is essentially an Israeli citizen, always a Jewish Israeli citizen, who has gone to live on what is known as a settlement on the West Bank, which is essentially a residential neighbourhood that that has been constructed on land nearly always expropriated from Palestinians in the West Bank. These settlements are considered illegal by the vast majority of international law experts because under international law, it is not allowed for an occupying power to try and alter the demographics of the area it's occupying to do anything around population transfer, which includes moving in its own population.
Now, can you take me through the pattern of settlements since 1967, since the Israelis occupied the West Bank? Where have they expanded and by how much and what kinds of different settlements are there?
So the first settlements were built pretty soon after the occupation began. In 1968, we first started seeing the construction of settlements in the West Bank. They have expanded really significantly across nearly the whole of the West Bank. What's really important to keep in mind about the settlements as well is that how they are constructed really breaks up the territory of the West Bank. It prevents significant contiguous Palestinian chunks of land. The settlements often cut right across Palestinian lands. And in some cases now, the settlements are really quite highly developed because they've been there for decades and decades. But they also, as part of this sort of separate system, they operate often in a way that's quite remote from the Palestinians who they live among. So they're often situated on hilltops, on high areas. They have often a fortress demeanour to them. And there are also these roads that run across the West Bank and between the West Bank and Israel that are essentially settler-only roads that allow settlers to move between settlements and to move between their settlements and Israel itself in a way that is not accessible to Palestinians.
And is the business of settlements still happening? Are new settlements currently being created and have been in recent years?
Yes, they have been. It's been an ongoing process under every Israeli government, essentially, since 1967, of all political stripes.
OK, now, there are also refugee camps in the West Bank, Palestinian refugee camps. What exactly are refugees in the West Bank refugees from?
They are predominantly refugees from 1948 as a result of mass displacement, direct expulsions, fighting that took place in 1948 and who then took refuge in places across the West Bank. Some of them have been displaced sometimes more than once.
OK. And finally, let's just talk about how the West Bank is governed now. Obviously, it's under Israeli occupation, but that's not the whole picture, is it?
Right, yes. So, as I said, after 1967, the West Bank came under Israeli military occupation. And in that early period, it was really military governors who were in charge of the West Bank. However, in the 1990s, we had the Oslo Accords, which were a series of agreements between the Israeli government and what was what's known as the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which was led by Yasser Arafat, which was by that point widely recognized as the main representative of the Palestinian people. Now, the Oslo Accords were designed to essentially set the stage for what was said to be ultimately a long-term peace settlement. As part of the Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority was created as a kind of what was meant to be an interim, sort of half-time authority in parts of the West Bank.
So what does the Palestinian Authority actually control or affect?
Well, in reality, quite little. So the Palestinian Authority has limited control over a small part of the West Bank, parts known as Area A, and it is in charge of essentially civil affairs in those areas. So, it has responsibility for things like health and education. But because it is not a fully sovereign state, it remains under the largesse of the Israeli state, and it works very closely with the Israeli state on things like security.
Our near farm with the background. Now let's look at what's happening in the West Bank as we speak. Joining me in the briefing room is Dalia Hatuka, an independent journalist specialising in Palestinian-Israeli affairs based in Ramallah on the West Bank. Dalia Hatuka, since the 7th of October, the focus has very much been on Gaza. But what's been going on in the West Bank since then?
I think it's important to kind of go back a step. Right before October 7th, we have had in the West Bank one of the most violent periods for the territory since 2005. This is according to UN statistics. And I think it's worth mentioning that there's a baseline in the West Bank. So it's not like things just happen on October 7th. Before that, there was an average killing about one Palestinian per day, for example. If we are to talk about some of the changes that have happened in the weeks since October 7th, I see some changes that are kind of reminiscent of the days of the Second Intifada, in the late 2000s. So an increase in the ferocity of settler attacks, an increase in the numbers of Israeli military checkpoints. If we look at the numbers, since 7th of October, we've had more than 200 Palestinians, about 50 of them children, being killed by Israeli forces. This is in the West Bank. We have had 8 people, including one child, who was killed by Israeli settlers. Also, we've been seeing almost daily raids in the West Bank into mostly refugee camps in Tul Karem, Nablus, Jenin, especially, where the Israeli army has been rounding up mostly Palestinian men. Some of them have been members of Hamas. Many others have not. I think the number is a little more than 2,000 have been detained in that short period of time. And the list includes former detainees, but also lots of activists, writers, teachers, students. In occupied East Jerusalem, things have been on edge, so to speak, because Israeli authorities have been closing the doors to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound where Muslims pray.
Because this has become a matter of some dispute since October the 7th, on the West Bank, the figures for deaths and so on, where do those come from?
They come from the Palestinian Authority, Ministry of Health.
As far as you know, not actually disputed by the Israeli authorities.
I don't think they've been disputed by anybody.
Most of the deaths you're talking about have been at the hands, as far as I can tell from what you're saying, of Israeli forces, then some from settler activity. Has there been a substantial increase in violence coming from settlers on the West Bank recently?
There has been an increase. If we were to look at some figures by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, they say that armed settlers have been increasing their attacks on Palestinian communities across the West Bank. They're often escorted by soldiers, or in some cases, the soldiers actually participate in the attacks.
What about violence on the part of Palestinians on the West Bank? What's been happening with that regard?
I think there's been some sporadic shootings here and there. There has been a number of small splinter armed groups that have grown, especially in refugee camps.
Dalia, what kind of Hamas presence is there in the West Bank? Is there one at all at the moment?
In general, the Hamas presence in the West Bank is very low. And also, Hamas members have been taken into custody. So there's not really much power for them in the West Bank like there is in the Gaza Strip.
Dalia Hatuka. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes several episodes on Israel and Palestine. There's also a couple of special Radio 4 series on the subject, The Mandates and A Complicated History. Now let's turn our attention back to the West Bank and its role in shaping the area's future. Joining me are Anshul Pfeffer, who's a senior correspondent for Haaretz and Israel correspondent for The Economist. He's also the author of Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu. And Dr. Louise Kettle, Assistant Professor of International Relations at the University of Nottingham and Associate Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Anshul Pfeffer, why is what happens in the West Bank so important to the overall picture of the Israel-Palestine situation?
Well, first of all, the West Bank has the largest of all the Palestinian communities. Over 3 million Palestinians live in the West Bank. The second thing, which is something we should always remember when we're discussing what Hamas were trying to do in their October 7 massacre in Israel, it was not just an attack targeting Israel. It was obviously mainly an attack targeting Israeli civilians. But more than anything else, the Hamas attack was also a challenge to the Palestinian Authority. It was a challenge for leadership, the Palestinian people, the Palestinian national cause. And Hamas were basically saying to the Palestinians and the Fatah, which rules the West Bank or the Palestinian Authority, we are the ones fighting. We are the ones leading the resistance to Israel. Look how much damage we've just caused Israel. And the West Bank is one of the main arenas where this challenge between Hamas and Fatah will play out.
Right. Louise, since we're talking about the Palestinian Authority, what do we observe them as having been doing since October the 7th?
Well, we've seen Mahmoud Abbas, president of the state of Palestine. He's been involved in a lot of diplomacy regionally and internationally to try and work out what are the next steps, because the big question that's coming out of all of this is what happens to Gaza next? It's clear that it is not acceptable for the Israelis that Hamas remain in power there. So there has to be a new governing authority. And the sort of obvious solution would be to look to the authority in the West Bank and talk to the Palestinian Authority about it. The trouble with that is that the Palestinian Authority is particularly weak at the moment. It is perceived as weak by Palestinians and is not particularly seen as in touch. It's thought of as quite corrupt. That it's has cooperated with Israel on sort of intelligence and security measures, that it's been sort of treacherous for being open to negotiation with the Israelis. So the Palestinian Authority generally is not particularly popular.
Anshul, how is the Palestinian Authority regarded by the Israeli government? Does it give it significant credence? Does it think it an important or powerful body? Or does it essentially disregard it?
Well, you say the word Israeli government, and you're not talking about one identity thinking in one strategy or with one agenda. Parts of the Israeli government, certainly the defense establishment, work, as Louise just said, quite closely with the Palestinian Authority on a wide range of things, and they see them as the only viable Palestinian partner. Other parts of the Israeli government, certainly some of the coalition, the far-right parties in the coalition, who ultimately want to annex the West Bank to Israel, see the Palestinian Authority as a threat and even a rival for control of parts of the West Bank. So there isn't one Israeli government position on the Palestinian Authority. Right now, the situation is that they're working together. There's a lot of security cooperation, there's a lot of cooperation in many fields. It's certainly not an equal relationship in any way. Israel holds most of the power in that relationship. But that still has been the situation for 3 decades now, almost, since the Oslo Accords began, that the Palestinian Authority works with Israel as part of their semi-autonomous control, what used to be of the Gaza Strip and now of parts of the West Bank, and Israel holds the ultimate security power over the West Bank. So that I don't see that changing as regards the West Bank. The real question is there any chance of the Palestinian Authority reasserting its control, the control that it lost 16 years ago in the Gaza Strip?
Louise, sticking with the Palestinian Authority for the moment and its reputation or its standing, how is the Palestinian Authority regarded by regional and international powers? And I'm not talking about how they formally regard it, but how they actually regard it.
Yeah, I think very similarly, to be honest. Weak, but without much alternative. I mean, there are sort of other groups in the state of Palestine, but again, none of them are really considered to be strong enough or alternatives to Fatah. And instead, what we're seeing is lots of young Palestinians feel that they've got no other option than to take matters into their own hands because the Palestinian Authority is so weak. So we're seeing new militant groups emerging, for example, not with political affiliations and not controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Groups like Lion's Den in the city of Nablus and the Jenin Brigades in Jenin refugee camps. So these are ad hoc, much more local groups with unclear structures, unknown leaders, because the PA has been seen as failing to protect its people, defend its people, advocate effectively for its people, kind of push for any diplomatic initiatives that kind of ease tensions with Israel. And the additional element to that is Abbas himself. He is effectively a kind of illegitimate president. I mean, Mahmoud Abbas succeeded his arch rival, Yasser Arafat, to be elected as president in 2005. And that presidential mandate, therefore, expired 4 years later in 2009. And there have been no elections since then. As a result, that is, in fact, why Hamas refused to kind of accept him as a legitimate political leader, because of these lack of elections. But the reality is, as I say, there isn't an alternative. There's no sort of succession structure within the Palestinian Authority for who's going to take over Abbas. And he is 87 years old, so he's not going to be, you know, around forever. And it's not clear who will be next.
Anshul, given what Louise has been saying about these alternative forces growing up in the West Bank, and given also the activities of some Israeli settlers, how worried have you been in recent weeks that the violence will escalate significantly further in the West Bank?
Well, that's a great question because, as you said, we've seen so many acts of provocation by settlers. The question everyone's been asking basically since 2005 when the second intifada ended, is this a third intifada? And we're now over 18 years since then, and we still haven't seen the third intifada. And when we say intifada, we mean something really widespread, an uprising which is not just in one or two towns, but is across the board, across the entire West Bank. And we're still not seeing that now, despite everything that's happened over the last 7 weeks. And there are two main reasons, well, three main reasons for that, really. First of all, Israel is clamping down. Second of all, the Palestinian Authority, which immediately saw what happened on October 7 as a challenge to its power, is also clamping down on any sign of dissent. And the third thing is that there doesn't seem really to be an appetite amongst the wider Palestinian community in the West Bank for another intifada, for all the sacrifices that they'll have to pay for that.
I want to move this on to what can sometimes seem like the impossibly optimistic territory of any conceivable settlement. And Louise, to what extent do you think, looking at other Arab states, they're serious about facilitating a renewed, longer-term peace process?
I think the answer to that is very serious. And there's one big reason why that is the case, and that is self-interest. So what has been shifting over the region over the last few years has been increasing focus upon establishing stability. And that has mean that we are seeing states talking to states that they've not spoken to for a long time. The diplomacy is increasing across the region. And the reason for all of that is that particularly the Gulf states are thinking long term about their economies and how they're going to diversify their economies as the world is starting to shift away from hydrocarbons. And in order to do that, they need people to be able to trade with in their neighbourhood, and they need to encourage investment into their countries through businesses and other kind of economic sectors. So it is entirely in their interest to have a stable neighbourhood. And that is why we have been seeing, for example, the start of the rehabilitation of Assad in Syria back into the Arab fold, while we're seeing the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Obviously, we've got the Abraham Accords in 2020, and all of that is focused around stability. And so it is entirely in all of the Arab states' interest to try and ensure that as well.
But Louise, stability is different from a solution, isn't it? From judging from the way you describe it. The traditional notion has been that there should be a two-state solution, of which presumably the West Bank is an absolutely central part. Is that still the perspective of Western countries, the United States, Europe and so on, and maybe even some of the Arab states? They still believe that's the way to go?
Yeah, so all of them have been very kind of vocal that that's where they see the long-term solution. The two-state solution usually envisions the kind of independent state of Palestine along the state of Israel, west of the Jordan River, with the boundary between the two states, normally based around the 1967 lines. But that is clearly what's subject to a lot of dispute and a lot of kind of negotiation. Certainly the EU, from the UK, the US, the Arab states, that is what they are calling for. Now, the two-state solution has been around for a long time and it hasn't been reached. It is clearly very, very difficult. There are many things that make it difficult, not least the fact that we've got a lot of Israeli settlements, and settlement is part of an ideology that we've already kind of talked about that is ingrained within some of the current more right-wing ultra-nationalist parts of the Israeli government. Clearly, there are issues over highly religious areas and debates about that. Perhaps even new leadership is required. Whether it's even possible to reach a two-state solution with Netanyahu in power is also questionable, because he has often been a barrier to those kind of conversations. And there's also going to have to be an understanding of how the threats and security on both sides are really going to be managed long term if Israel is not kind of occupying Palestine.
I want to put that, therefore, directly to Anshul to help our listeners to understand how important politically in Israel is the settler movement. Because at one level, you could say, well, why doesn't Israel just rein in these settlers? The settlements seem to be the problem. If you could somehow do something about it, you could create a Palestinian state based on the West Bank. Could you take us through why the settlers seem to have so much political clout, or how much political clout they do have?
Well, currently we're in a situation where Benjamin Netanyahu is dependent on every single element of his coalition. He fought five elections, four of them were stalemated, to return to power, finally succeeding at the end of last year. And he needs every single element within this coalition, including the most far right of them. And the far right parties in his coalition also represent the settlers. Now, the settlers are not a huge part of Israeli society. We're talking, well, obviously, it depends how you count them. If you include also those living in East Jerusalem neighbors, which aren't that ideological, we're talking about roughly 500,000 Israelis out of a population which is now almost 10 million. So 5-6% of Israelis are settlers. Of those, most of them are living in sort of suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which are very, very near the Green Line, that don't really pose much of an obstacle to a two-state solution. You could just loop the border around them and give Palestinians other bits. But there is about 100,000 settlers who are deep in the West Bank, and those are the settlers with that ideology that Louise mentioned, in which is basically trying to block any type of two-state solution, any kind of recognition, really, of Palestinian nationality and state. This is a group which currently has a huge amount of power because Netanyahu's coalition is dependent upon them, and he's not going to do anything really to rein them in or to change their status. And I totally agree with Louise here. I don't see any real movement from the Israeli side towards any type of solution, or certainly a two-state solution, while there still is Netanyahu government. Now, one of the results of what just happened on October 7 could well be the end of Netanyahu's long, long time in office. But I think any type of discussion of the solutions and the way towards those solutions to the conflict will only really be possible in the post-Netanyahu era.
Louise, broadly, do you think that's what the international community are now hoping for? That they're actually sitting there hoping that one of the consequences of this terrible crisis is the replacement of Netanyahu and the possibility of moving back towards some kind of process?
I don't know about from a Netanyahu perspective, to be honest, but I do think that in amongst this whole situation, which has been incredibly dark and of no benefit to anyone, the sort of light of optimism is that perhaps we could push towards a more sustainable solution in the future, in the long term, as a result of this. So in the kind of social sciences that I work on, 7th of October would be called a critical juncture. So a point in time where something shifts so dramatically that all the kind of concepts that have previously been applied are thrown out of the window and you're forced to move into a different direction. And I think that is the kind of hope of most of the international community.
Louise Kettle there with Anshul Pfeffer. And my conclusion, if I'm rash enough to have one, is that the West Bank may still hold the promise of a future peace, but it will take effort and courage on both sides to fulfil that promise. My thanks to Anne Irfan, Dahlia Hatuka, Louise Kettle and Anshul Pfeffer. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Alex Lewis, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The sound engineer was Rod Farker and the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I just would take my glasses off and the executioner would start.
Can you imagine your job being to help legally kill people?
It's a hell of a thing to watch a man die.
I'm Livy Haydock, and I once heard the wildest story about how the USA ran short of death row drugs and had to find them in the UK.
The drugs used in some of the executions are supplied by a British businessman.
That got me digging into what death row looks like now.
Well, they all died. Nobody complained.
And what might happen to it in the future. This is Killing Death Row from BBC Radio 4. With me, Livy Haydock. Listen on BBC Sounds.
if there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.